Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on advances in precision testing to guide care for patients with non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Dr. Sonia Thasek, Isabel Prishikal, and Surum Stuart Yang will discuss cases of patients with non-small cell lung cancer harboring actionable alterations. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from Lilly, Nuvation Bio, and Revolution Medicines. In the first segment, Dr. Prishikal discusses the case of a patient with metastatic lung adenocarcinoma and a G12C mutation.
So here's our case. We have a 60-year-old woman with a history of lung cancer. She has a 30-pack year smoking history, had bilateral multifocal lung cancers in the right middle lobe that was treated locally that we will go through, as well as the left upper lobe. And since receiving local therapy, she had been followed with surveillance imaging. So here we have the definitive management of her right middle lobe adenocarcinoma. It was treated with radiation therapy, and you can see there is evidence of radiation fibrosis on imaging. No actionable alterations were noted with this adenocarcinoma on the right lung. And over here, you have the pathology specimen from her left upper lobe resected tissue, positive for TTF1, indicating non-small cell lung adenocarcinoma, 1.2 centimeters, positive for pleural invasion, positive for lymphovascular invasion, all angry features that we know about. Stations 5 and stations 9 lymph nodes were sampled and were negative for disease, classifying this as a YPT2A N0 non-small cell adenocarcinoma. Next generation sequencing on this specimen revealed a KRAS G12C alteration with a variant allele frequency of about 16%. PD-L1 was also noted to be high at 70%. So just to review, we have a right middle lobe cancer adenocarcinoma, no actionable alterations that was treated with radiation. And then you have a left upper lobe wedge with a KRAS G12C alteration, PD-L1 70%. So let's just go through the KRAS landscape a little bit here. So KRAS alterations in general are the most common oncogenic mutation seen in patients with non-small cell lung cancer, ranging up to close to 30% of cases. It's most commonly seen in patients with a smoking history or current smoking history. However, there are KRAS alterations that are seen in patients with no smoking history, or rather light smoking history, and that tends to be patients with a KRAS G12D, as in dog, alteration. So I won't belabor this too much. However, the way that RAS proteins work is they function more so in the upstream pathway. And what they do is that they sort of link to the cell surface and they activate downstream pathways, which could lead to metastasis, which can lead to proliferation, which can lead to cell migration and cell survival, right? So if these get activated, those pathways get going. So when the KRAS GTPase function is mutated or impaired, it gets locked in the active form, which allows these pathways of proliferation, migration, and survival to just keep going and going, which leads to tumor growth. So if I were to give this talk about 5 to 10 years ago, the slide probably wouldn't exist, or maybe we would have the beginnings of sotorasib clinical trials. And I'm very excited to let you all know that in the G12C space, we have two FDA approvals, sotorasib and adagrasib. These are both oral therapy tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are taken in the second line setting and beyond for patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer harboring KRAS G12C alterations. And then looking after adagrasib down on the graph below, we have various other agents that are still in clinical trial. We have divarasib, we have olomorasib, and various others. When looking specifically at divarasib, we have divarasib doing more so head-to-head studies against standard of care tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But when looking at olomorasib, this is a oral drug that's getting tested in the frontline setting. So we are trying to see if there's any activity for moving these KRAS G12C inhibitors up forward, right? So we have trials looking at olomorasib plus pembro, olomorasib plus chemo plus pembro, and various others. So looking a little bit about olomorasib, which is a KRAS G12C off inhibitor, right? So we're trying to keep that GTPase off so the downstream signaling does not happen. We have two studies, right? There's olomorasib plus chemo plus pembro in the frontline setting, which is on the left. And then you have olomorasib plus single agent pembro, which is on the right. And looking at these waterfall plots, this is absolutely beautiful, right? The majority of patients on study are having a very nice response. But when you're looking at the more fine data, if you're looking at overall response rate on the left with the olomorasib plus chemo plus pembro, you can see that those all comers have an overall response rate of about 73%. But those with a high PD-L1 expression, meaning greater than 50%, have an overall response rate of around 78%. Then if I move your eyes over to the graph on the right, you have olomorasib plus pembro in the frontline setting. And when you're looking at the overall response rate here, which is in the graph on the bottom in the gray, you can see that those have a PD-L1 that's greater than 50%, have a 90% response rate, as opposed to those that get chemo and immunotherapy and olomorasib with a response rate of 78%. So that's going to be very relevant with our case, which I will get to shortly. But the long story short is there's no exact right answer here. Similar to KEYNOTE-189, carbo-pemi-pembro versus KEYNOTE-024, which is single agent pembro. Historically, we would say that patients that had a high PD-L1 should get single agent pembro. But there are patients that have high PD-L1s that have a large burden of disease that we like to add chemotherapy to. So I would say these are both great trial options, but we can get into the weeds a little bit more about why we chose one over the other. When looking at tolerability, I would say it, based on what you can see here, looking at treatment-related adverse events in the chemo arm, you can see that there were about 29 patients that needed a dose reduction, so 34%, as opposed to those in the Olo-Pembro arm, only 11 patients needed a dose reduction. And I'm sure some of that has to do with the chemotherapy that was added in there, which of course adds increased toxicity. When looking at how many patients actually needed to discontinue treatment, it was 10 patients in the chemo Olo-Pembro arm compared to those that were just on Olo-Pembro where it was just 2 patients. So I had been talking about RAS-off inhibitors, right? Sotorasib, adagrasib, olomorasib. Now we're going to talk about RAS-on inhibitors. So let's just do a quick review. So for KRAS G12C inhibitors, sotorasib, adagrasib, olomorasib that I had mentioned before, we are looking at RAS-off inhibitors that are binding to that GTPase and trying to prevent that GTPase from turning on. So you're locking it in the off position. RAS-on inhibitors, which are these two drugs, daxanrasib and elironrasib, mouthfuls, are RAS-on inhibitors. So they target the GTP-bound active state, and by blocking that interaction, they prevent the downstream effectors. So these RAS-on inhibitors are trying to target the patients that may have resistance to the GTPase RAS-off inhibitors. So if something has allowed that RAS-off inhibitor to then turn on, you're able to hit it with this RAS-on inhibitor. So when looking at these two studies, daxanrasib versus elironrasib, at first glance, daxanrasib is really involving studies for patients that have KRAS G12X, right? Not just G12C. You could have various different G12, G13X, G61 alterations. You could have, you know, various other KRAS alterations are included in the daxanrasib studies versus elironrasib, RMC-6291. These is another RAS-on inhibitor, which is really focusing on patients with G12C alterations. It looks like the median duration of response is about 15.1 months in the daxanrasib studies. Median progression-free survival is somewhere in the order of 9.8 months, which is not bad in the second-line setting at all, with a median overall survival of 17.7 months. Seems to be a little bit more favorable than the elironrasib, but obviously we don't want to do cross-trial comparisons. So moving a little bit beyond KRAS G12C, we have the alphabet soup of KRAS alterations. So we're focusing on KRAS G12D here and beyond. I just wanted to give a little bit of a history about KRAS G12D. So this alteration, as I'd mentioned previously, is seen in patients with maybe no smoking history or a light smoking history, We do note that KRAS alterations are also seen in patients with GI malignancies, colorectal cancer, pancreatic cancer. So it's not unique to lung only. We're really looking at targets, right? Combining targets here. So in addition to RAS inhibitors, we're looking at SHP2, we're looking at SOS1, MEK, mTOR, you name it, because we need to figure out how we can get fancy and not inhibit only upstream, but also anticipate and inhibit all of that downstream effect that can lead to proliferation, migration, metastasis, and survival. Moving on. So now let's go back to our patient. And really just to kind of drive that point home, as we heard earlier, next generation sequencing is really, really, really important. It's not just okay to know that your patient has a KRAS alteration. Historically speaking, maybe that was okay. You would know that this was a poor player, bad prognosis. Now you really need to know, is this KRAS G12C? Is it KRAS G12D? Is it KQ61H? What are we actually dealing with, right? Because we are learning that we can start to personalize therapy for these patients. So when jumping back to our patient, she had her right upper lobe, but right middle lobe radiated, left upper lobe wedge resection. She was followed with surveillance imaging, but then unfortunately 6 months later, she was known to have FDG avid liver lesions. She underwent an IR guided biopsy with molecular testing that revealed a KRAS G12C alteration with a PD-L1 of 70% in this liver lesion. MRI brain was thankfully negative for metastatic disease. So here we have the tissue. You can see the TTF1 staining. This is of the liver core biopsy. And then we did the genomic profiling, right? So we ran next generation sequencing. And if you remember, the right middle lobe did not have any actionable alterations, but the left upper lobe wedge did have a KRAS G12C alteration with a high PD-L1. And then when we ran next generation sequencing on the IR-guided liver biopsy, we found the same KRAS G12C alteration, as well as two other alterations down at the bottom that were concurrent BLM and FAH. So this is concluding that unfortunately, this patient's left upper lobe disease has now metastasized to her liver. They harbor the same KRAS G12C alterations, high PD-L1. This is considered stage 4, unfortunately. So we need to think about what are our options here. And we actually have a plethora of options, right? We have standard of care chemo-IO, carbo-pemi-pembro. We could offer single agent pembro. She has a high PD-L1. We could offer a sotorasib single agent frontline clinical trial, right? Sotorasib is only approved in the second line setting as of right now. We could offer olomorasib plus pembro, or we could offer olomorasib plus chemo plus pembro. Both of those are clinical trials. So according to this patient, she really wasn't interested in IV chemotherapy at this time. She was excited about clinical trials. She was excited about immunotherapy and signed consent for the olomorasib pembro frontline clinical trial, given her high PD-L1 and KRAS G12C alteration. And thankfully, at her 10-month follow-up, she's remained in partial response with a good performance status, seems to be tolerating well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Pershakov, for a wonderful presentation. This case is now open for any questions.
You know, in these patients with KRAS mutations, we often see co-mutations, right, in STK11 and KEAP1, which we know are sort of bad actors in these disease subsets. So I'm just curious to hear your thoughts is on how the presence of these mutations influences your decision in terms of treatment for KRAS inhibitors, for clinical trials, and also immunotherapy.
Great question, Stu. Thank you for that. Yes, we do know that these co-mutations, STK11 and KEAP1, are bad players. The first thing that I do anytime I see these co-mutations present with a KRAS alteration is sort of set the stage for my patient that this is more of an aggressive disease. We are wanting to always give our best treatment first. And I tend to follow them a little bit more closely, right? We always scan at six weeks after starting treatment. But if I note that there's any clinical change, I often would have a very low bar to scan them again. So that's number one. For this patient, if they had KEAP1, STK11, KRAS G12, whatever, I would need to look at first disease burden, right? We have to think about what are also things that are poor players, right? So liver metastases, brain metastases, high disease burden. I would probably favor, if we were looking at a clinical trial, I would probably favor chemotherapy plus olomorasib plus pembro for this patient, I think they might benefit from having more in that setting. It tends to be my practice, but I know that's not always everybody's practice, but I tend to give a little bit more for these patients because of those poor co-mutations, and we know how they do on studies typically.
In the final segment, Dr. Yang discusses the case of a patient with lung adenocarcinoma harboring a ROS1 fusion.
Here we have a 50-year-old woman. She has no smoking history and really no other significant past medical history either. And a routine preoperative chest x-ray was performed for elective cholecystectomy, and unfortunately a new right hilar perihilar opacity was identified. And so a follow-up CT scan showed these following findings with a 4.2 centimeter right upper low mass, as well as mediastinal lymphadenopathy and metastases in the liver, bone, a pleural fusion, and a brain MRI, fortunately, was negative. And so all of this picture is really concerning for stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer with a lung primary. And so as part of a diagnostic and also a therapeutic procedure, a thoracocentesis was performed to drain that pleural fusion specimen. So as we know, we get the body cavity fluid, we centrifuge it to create a cell pellet, and then that cell pellet is then used to prepare smears, liquid-based cytology, as well as a cell block and FFPE. And you can see on the picture on the right that we see a malignant tumor cells that are consistent with metastatic adenocarcinoma in the pleural fluid, establishing stage 4 disease. It's TTF1 positive, PD-L1 0. And here was actually quite abundant tumor purity, which we can see often in these effusion samples with 50% tumor cellularity. And so this material was actually sent off for NGS by the pathologist per the reflex testing protocol that was implemented at the institution. And so here we have, again, the cell block with abundant tumor cells, and then we perform DNA-based NGS, which is often the case in a lot of centers. And then this is the result that we see here. We have a U2AF1 S34F mutation, which is a recurrent oncogenic mutation, but it's not a classic sort of driver that we see in lung cancer, particularly in patients with never smoking history as well as a younger patient. And so here we can start thinking about, you know, what is the next course of action that we can think about as a next diagnostic step? And so as, we alluded to in the prior talk, here we also did RNA-based NGS given the driver negative status in the DNA-based NGS. And here we found a CD74 ROS1 fusion, which is a known driver, and we'll talk more about this later. But now with this new finding, the patient is considered eligible for these ROS1 TKIs, which are highly effective in these populations. It really changes the course and the trajectory of this patient's management. And so here for this case, I wanted to quickly review some important topics, including reflex testing and how it's really important for our biomarker testing workflow, as well as integrating RNA NGS, and talk a little bit more about ROS1 fusions specifically. So let's talk a little bit about reflex biomarker testing in non-small cell lung cancer. So historically, biomarker testing has really relied on these clinician-requested orders, where these orders would come in from the clinician after they see the patient, after a pathologist has made the diagnosis and issued a report. And then once the order comes in, the pathologists have to go back to the specimen, look at the material, choose the best block, and then send off the material for NGS. And now, increasingly, we're doing this pathology-initiated reflex workflow where both the pathologic diagnosis as well as molecular testing is happening all at the same time by the pathologist. And this is really beneficial, I think, because it minimizes the delay and also minimizes the turnaround time because everything is happening at once, right? It also increases the testing rates and reduces any bias that we have because, you know, we're not necessarily seeing the patient. We're just trying to test everybody with adequate tumor cellularity. And then I think it's also very helpful for tissue stewardship and conservation because we're thinking about both the diagnosis and biomarker testing at the same time, so we're better able to understand and prioritize biomarker testing when we're handling especially these small samples. And so there are also important considerations that we have to think about for implementing reflex testing. So I think, as with a lot of other protocols, we really need to make sure that we have great multidisciplinary coordination between the different multidisciplinary teams. So we have to have buy-in from not only the pathologists, but also the medical oncologists, the surgeons, radiation oncologists. So everyone has to be on board. And we also have to establish the actual workflow and the criteria for how to, you know, make this work for everyone. So are we going to do the send out? Is it going to be in-house testing? Are we going to do just for the adenos? Are we going to consider other histologies like squamous cell carcinoma? And how are we going to implement this for early stage as well as advanced stage? Because as we've heard, there are approved agents for early stage lung cancer as well. And then importantly, we also need to engage with a lot of the other stakeholders in this process, including hospital administrators, insurance, and payers, to make sure that this is financially sustainable. And then, of course, we have to continue updating our reflex biomarker protocol with new approvals that come down the pipeline. So here, I just wanted to talk now about the importance of RNA-based NGS for detecting actionable fusions as well as some supply-side variants. And so just wanted to, you know, highlight that there are really two sort of pictures in here. So the first, we're talking about how, you know, DNA-based NGS can actually miss some clinically actionable fusions and splicing events due to some issues with the technical design of the assay and the intronic tiling. And so this can lead to limited sensitivity of DNA-based NGS for detecting these fusions. And this is a study that we conducted here at MSK, where we found all these really actionable kinase fusions on our RNA sequencing that was performed on DNA negative cases on MSK impact. And so this really highlights that RNA-based NGS can detect fusions that are missed by DNA-based only panels. And so what does this mean for us practically, right? So, you know, what this tells us is that lung cancers lacking canonical RTK, RAS/RAF drivers should really be analyzed with further RNA sequencing by a reflex workflow or as a send out to a different lab. And sort of on the other side of the picture, we also know that DNA-based NGS can detect fusions of unclear significance or even splice-side variants that we're not sure if it actually leads to splicing events that may or may not be actionable. So this is an issue of limited specificity. And so we can often detect on DNA-based panels kinase fusions that we don't know if these are really activating and actionable. So these include things that lack the kinase domain, which is the main engine of that gene, if it's an out-of-frame fusion, or if it's not in the right orientation. For example, if ROS1 is in the upstream partner rather than the downstream partner. And then, as I mentioned before, we can also see some splice variants of unclear significance, where if it's like a deep intronic mutation in intron 13 and 14 in MET, we don't know if this is going to really lead to MET exon 14 skipping. And so I think here RNA-based NGS can also help clarify these fusions of unclear significance reported from the DNA-based NGS. And so in these cases, when we get these atypical or results that are ambiguous, we can definitely, we should be sending these cases for RNA-based sequencing. And so now we know that, you know, combined DNA and RNA-based testing is really the most optimal, right, the most sensitive and specific method for detecting these fusions. And so how do we go about in creating a workflow that can support this practice? So there are two ways. So the first, you could do a DNA or RNA sequential method. And this is actually what we do at MSK, where we screen initially with DNA-based NGS. And then if it's positive for a driver, then you're good. But if it's a negative for drivers, especially in never smokers, or if you get some atypical result of unknown significance, that's when you do RNA-based NGS to help clarify and to make sure that we're catching all these fusions. And then you could also do DNA and RNA co-testing, dual testing upfront, where, of course, you know, we would be doing everything at once, and so you'll get the answer there. So some considerations in these two different workflows. So for sequential co-testing, you know, this is potentially more judicious and cost-effective use of RNA sequencing because we're only doing it for cases that really need it. But this may cause some delays and requires more manual review and sort of specialized expertise in being able to understand these nuances of technical results. And then for upfront co-testing, right, this is obviously very rapid and it's decision-free and everything's automatically done, but it may actually not be necessary for all cases, especially for, you know, for patients that we found an EGFR mutation at baseline. There's really no need to do RNA testing for any clinically actionable sort of insights further than from that. And so this can be also cost prohibitive in some low resource settings. So now moving on to ROS1 fusions, we know that these are driver oncogenic alterations that occur in about 1 to 2% of lung adenocarcinomas. It was first identified in 2007, and they have a lot of different fusion partners, but the most common is actually the CD74 ROS1, which is what our patient had. And what this results in is a constitutively active kinase domain that leads to oncogenic addiction and tumorigenesis. And some of the clinical associations with this fusion are that these are enriched in never or light smokers, or younger age at diagnosis, and endocarcinoma histology, so just like our patient. So in terms of testing for ROS1, we can use a variety of methods. So you can actually use IHC for screening, especially the D4, D6 clone. Historically, we've been using break-apart FISH. We can also use RT-PCR, but for that, you actually need to know the fusion partner. And then, of course, we can use NGS with a combined DNA and RNA for comprehensive detection of these fusions without having to know the actual fusion partner. And so what this tells us is that, you know, ROS1 IHC could be used for screening, but if it's positive, we actually have to have molecular confirmation because it is highly sensitive but not specific. And then RNA-based NGS is obviously more sensitive compared to DNA-based only panels, and particularly for ROS1 because there's a very repetitive element in the intron where a lot of these fusions occur, and actually CD74 ROS1 is one of the most commonly missed fusions from DNA sequencing panels. And then, of course, we need to do integrated DNA and RNA testing for ROS fusion detection. And so thinking about sort of the treatment landscape for ROS1 targeted therapies, you know, it's really been evolving in the past decade. So we've initially had these sort of first generation TKIs that are approved in 2016 with crizotinib, and then now we have a lot of new agents that are highly more effective, active against some of these resistance mutations that we're seeing after treatment with ROS TKI, including repotrectinib, taletrectinib, and as you can see, there's even some that are in clinical trials as well. And so you can see, and all of these agents lead to really high response rates of up to 89% with durable control. And the unfortunate reality for these patients, especially ROS1 patients, is that they develop a lot of CNS metastasis. So we have to make sure that a lot of these agents have good CNS activity. And so here, you know, ROS1 detection, and in this case and in many other patients, really, you know, fundamentally changes the treatment course for our patients, shifting from chemo IO to highly effective target therapies. And as we've talked about, accurate detection really is critical for making sure that these patients receive these highly effective, well-tolerated targeted options. And then we really need to, you know, do a better job in understanding the potential delays and under-testing in our molecular diagnostic workflows that can have direct clinical impact for our patients. So just to quickly summarize our patient, you know, this was a 50-year-old woman, no smoking history, was stage 4 lung adenocarcinoma. She had a pleural fusion, which was drained, and we're actually able to perform molecular testing on this cytology sample with reflex testing. And the DNA-based testing was negative for any drivers, but RNA-based testing actually found a ROS1 fusion, and now the patient is candidate for ROS1 targeted therapies. And so just wanted to highlight a few discussion points here, which is that, you know, anyone with lungs can get lung cancer, right? You know, we've always thought that, you know, lung cancer was a smoker's disease, but the face of lung cancer is really changing, and so we need to recognize this important fact. And then also, you know, cytology samples are really critical in our workflow, including body fusion samples, and a lot of times these could be more enriched in tumor cells than biopsies. And then we also talked about the value of reflex testing protocols and how it really, you know, benefits and optimizes our workflow, the utility of RNA-based NGS, and the need for integrated DNA and RNA-based testing, and how ROS1 fusions are really an important, a rare but important actionable driver, and all the different types of therapies that we can give to these patients.
There's a good question about, is there a guideline suggestion for squamous cell carcinoma testing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it really depends on the clinical context. You know, for us, we would consider, you know, full NGS in patients with squamous cell carcinoma that are, you know, never light smoking history or younger patients. I think that's a reasonable approach. I mean, we at MSK, we do everyone. So, you know, all patients with squamous histology would also get tested, but I think in sort of more resource-constrained settings, you can start thinking about a subgroup of squamous cell carcinomas that may be highly enriched for these driver alterations, which are, again, never light smokers or, you know, younger patients.
Yeah. Although NCCN guidelines actually recently addressed testing for squamous cell carcinoma in metastatic setting and advanced, so squamous is basically paving the way, and always the testing in the never smokers, younger with the squamous cell was always.
And then any component of adeno, if it's like adenosquamous, we would treat it as adenocarcinoma.
All right. Oops. I just lost question. There was a one question about the ROS1 testing for by PCR, I think.
Yeah, another great question. So there are a lot of PCR assays, actually newer ones that have come out that actually can detect ROS1 fusions as well as other fusions. We actually use it as a potential screen in our cases, and it's been quite good. It detects both, you have to know the fusion partner, and it also can detect the imbalance in the expression levels of ROS1 fusions between the upstream partner as well as the downstream partner. But essentially, I think it's a good tool. Obviously, we want to do NGS if possible, but if that's not possible, or if you want a more quicker approach, then you could consider PCRs with ROS1, understanding the limitations of PCR, right? Which is that it's not going to capture everything.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.